For Tuesday, August 8, 2006, this is Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. The U.S. Secretary of Energy encourages the opening of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to further oil exploration. The U.N. Security Council and the Arab League meet to attempt to hammer out a realistic proposal for peace. And the United States military steps up its attack on the Sadr movement in Iraq. We'll bring you those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Israeli airstrikes have killed at least 14 villagers in southern Lebanon today, pushing the Lebanese death toll to over 1,000. The Lebanese government is pressing the UN Security Council to adopt reforms to a U.S.-French-backed ceasefire plan, as the country faces its toughest set of crises since Hezbollah captured two Israeli soldiers on July 12th. Jackson Allers reports from Beirut.
Among the many casualties of war during the near four-week Israeli military offensive is a growing environmental disaster along the Lebanese coastline. Nearly 90 miles of coastline has been covered by more than 14,000 tons of oil that is spreading north into Syrian waters. Marine analysts say that the oil spill will affect the fishing industry for at least 2 to 3 years and that a cleanup is not possible until a ceasefire is complete. Meanwhile, the Lebanese government called up 15,000 reserve troops to fulfill their commitment to a domestic ceasefire plan that would put Lebanese government forces in control of the southern territories, areas that Israel intends to occupy in the coming weeks, part of the Israeli government's strategy to force Hezbollah from the southern Lebanese border. And today, as the United Nations Security Council debates changes to the U.S.-backed ceasefire agreement, Israel dropped thousands of leaflets onto the coastal city of Tyre in southern Lebanon, indicating that any moving vehicle would be considered hostile and would face Israeli missile attacks. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, this is Jackson Allers in Beirut, Lebanon.
Sri Lankan rebels today released water from a disputed irrigation reservoir, ending a 20-day blockade that had instigated fierce clashes between government forces and the Tamil Tigers. In a separate development, 14 local aid workers were found dead in a battered nearby town. The French charity Action Against Hunger said it has suspended its mission to Sri Lanka following the massacre of its local staff in the country. Punia Manikavasagam has more.
On July 20th, Tamil Tiger rebels blocked the Mavilaru irrigation water supply to 30,000 acres of paddy lands in the government-held area. The government launched an offensive to open the water gates and fierce fighting erupted between the two parties in the eastern town of Muthu, and hundreds of combatants and civilians were killed. The rebels said that they want the government to fulfill the long-felt basic needs, including drinking water, the people in their area. Hours after, Norway's peace envoy John Hansen Bar clinched a deal with the rebels on Sunday to open the Mavilaru Canal, the government launched fresh artillery attacks. Senior rebel leader Elilan said they opened the water gates on humanitarian grounds and at the request of the Norwegian government. Meanwhile, the funeral of 17 local aid workers killed in Muthu took place in Trincomalee today. The tragic death of these people has sent shockwaves among the aid agencies engaged in relief and rehabilitation projects in the country. The European Union has urged the government to take legal action against the perpetrators and to assure the safety of the humanitarian workers. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ponnaiah Manikavasagam in Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
Floods in Ethiopia have claimed more than 200 lives since the weekend. Over 10,000 people have been left homeless in the eastern city of Dire Dawa. Hundreds of people are still missing. The updated death toll comes amid new warnings of flash floods for lowland regions. Aid workers in the Democratic Republic of Congo say that internally displaced civilians in the northeast are dying for lack of food. Violence still rages in areas of the DRC, although the country's devastating civil war formally ended 3 years ago. A UN humanitarian aid coordinator told Reuters that an estimated 10 people die each day in one camp that shelters some 40,000 displaced persons. Some of the displaced are left with no choice but to return to their fields in areas patrolled by violent militia groups. The civil war in the DRC has been ranked as the deadliest conflict since World War II. More than 2,000 miners in the world's largest private copper mine, La Escondida, went on strike yesterday demanding better wages and working conditions. FSRN's Jorge Garretón reports from Santiago.
The striking miners are demanding a 13% pay increase and a one-time bonus of some $30,000 per worker because of the high price of copper in world markets. They also demand pay benefits because they have to work under a harsh environment at nearly 10,000 feet in the mountains. La Escondida, owned by the Anglo-Australian Mine Consortium, BHP Billiton, is offering only 3% increase in wages. La Escondida produces 8% of the world's copper, and last year the mine had record profits of $2.5 billion. Union officials say La Escondida is operating at 30% capacity with non-union labor and scab miners. Company officials say the mine is working at 40% capacity. Union leader Pedro Marin calls the strike historical and says it is the rebirth of the mining union movement silence after the 1973 military coup. Marin says they have the support of other mining unions, but warns that miners need to be responsible in their demands because Chile's economy and success is owed largely to its commodities. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
U.S. Secretary of Energy Samuel Bodman showed optimism for the U.S.'s capacity to make up for the 400,000 barrels of oil that will be lost due to BP's pipeline leak in Prudhoe Bay, Alaska. As FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, amidst his assurances, he encouraged the opening of the ANWR to further oil exploration.
The U.S. oil supply has 15 million more barrels than it did last year. One-third of that stock is on the West Coast. They're the main recipient of Alaska crude. According to Energy Secretary Samuel Bodman, that will help the U.S. during this latest oil mess.
It appears from the conversations as well as EIA's work that there is enough supply of crude oil to last at least for a couple of weeks during this interim period. And the further news is by and large pretty good. According to EIA, the lost production from Prudhoe Bay production can be made up for in several ways, including a drawdown of crude oil inventories or product stocks and a substitution for Alaska crude oil from other supplies.
Those other supplies include Saudi Arabia, Ecuador, Mexico, and Colombia. The Union of Concerned Scientists estimates that the U.S. spent $24 million in additional oil imports yesterday alone. 400,000 barrels per day are expected to be lost this month and next, with a couple hundred thousand barrel shortage in the following months. That's according to the Department of Energy's short-term energy outlook. And if oil, by chance, does run out...
We have the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, or the SPRO as we call it internally, which currently holds about 688 million barrels of crude oil and may be used in the case of severe supply disruption. That's why it's there. In addition, if needed, we could request a waiver of the Jones Act from the Department of Homeland Security, which would allow more barges to transport crude oil around the country.
Energy Secretary Bodman hosted a rare press briefing to assure the markets and consumers that oil is abundant. The briefing comes one day after British Petroleum, one of the five largest oil companies, announced they have to close three-fourths of their 22-mile pipeline. That pipeline delivers oil to the major Trans-Alaskan pipeline. Corrosion of unmaintained pipes caused the oil leak. BP is still determining if they'll have to shut down the entire pipe. Chuck Hamel, former employee of BP and current advocate of pipeline workers, says BP has known about and ignored this problem for many years.
They didn't clean the sludge out. Very simple. But they can't afford to clean the sludge out with pipes that are lines that are about to leak. You're making it worse. It's like Swiss cheese up there.
Hamel predicts further disruptions in oil supply and the situation to only get worse. Meanwhile, Energy Secretary Bodman said the U.S. doesn't have the alternative sources of energy to make up for lost fuel sources. His suggestion?
We should develop ANWR, develop the oil there. We believe that we need more natural gas from Alaska. We are very hopeful that the legislature in Alaska will react favorably to that response.
Bodman championed the Energy Policy Act, which passed Congress 1 year ago. It's the major energy reform bill that took years to pass. It's touted by supporters as expanding energy diversity by providing loan guarantees and tax credits to alternative fuel sources, nuclear power, and clean coal technology. But critics like Kevin Curtis with the National Environmental Trust says the Energy Policy Act is much of the same.
in the scheme of federal budgets, a couple billion dollars when Exxon earns $10 billion a quarter is nothing.
Agreed, says Justin Tathan with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group.
They're sending one message to the public that is much more of a nice, happy-feeling message around trying to alleviate people's concerns about gas prices and energy issues. But then I think it's, at the same time, they're not doing enough in the call to Congress or in the administration through budgeting and in making the investments in these programs.
Continuing to promote fossil fuels, in July, the Senate passed a bill that expands offshore drilling to the Gulf of Mexico. The House of Representatives passed a much more expansive bill a few weeks earlier that would allow drilling along the entire U.S. continental shelf. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leon Caldwell.
The Arab League, composed of foreign ministers from 20 countries, met in Beirut yesterday and rejected a UN resolution drafted by the U.S. and France. Yahya Mahmasani is the permanent observer to the UN from the League of Arab States. He said the current proposal has a discriminatory tone, adding that three key details are missing from the draft.
We need to make sure that the Israeli forces withdraw behind the blue line, and there should be a ceasefire. Two, they should tackle the question of the Shabaa farms. The third point, there should be the transfer of the two Israeli soldiers and the Lebanese prisoners, including those who were abducted recently. There should be an equity. They should be done simultaneously.
The UN Security Council is meeting with a delegation of three Arab officials today. U.S. and French diplomats will hold a private meeting afterward to discuss possible changes to the resolution and may introduce a new draft by Wednesday. Meanwhile, the violence continues in the Middle East. Israeli warplanes destroyed five buildings along the main north-south coastal highway this week, killing five people, wounding 19 others, and completely isolating Beirut from the north of the country. The strikes destroyed the only remaining outlet via Syria after the bombardment of other border crossing points and might challenge the relationship between the city's Christian and Muslim communities. Christians were the majority in the region and Muslims were the minority in numbers until 22,000 refugees arrived from the southern war zone seeking shelter. FSRN's Khaled Sid Mohan reports from this Christian stronghold to assess if the destruction of the bridges is causing more than just physical damage.
Since the beginning of the war, Christian areas had been spared from Israeli bombardment. But the first strikes in the northern ancient city of Byblos drew much concern from the residents in the region. There have been increasing concerns about an extension of the war into their Christian area, and the fear of returning to sectarian strife seen during the 15-year civil war after 20,000 mostly Shia Muslim refugees arrived from the southern part of the country, which remains under Israeli fire. Marwan Sachs, 38, is a lawyer and the advisor of Carlos Edde, leader of the National Bloc, a political party which was part of an anti-Syrian movement traditionally hostile to Hezbollah. He expresses his concern about the presence of the refugees.
We are afraid that this issue may be the cause of a much more political and social problem in the near future. The region lives on a very, very sensitive balance between religious communities. So we have two-thirds of the region which is Christian and one-third Shia Muslim. So now with the 22,000 people Shia coming here, and we believe that they will not be able to go back to their homes soon, so some people think it may be a problem on the long term.
As the Lebanese electoral system is based on religious quotas, the National Bloc, to which Marwan belongs, worries about the consequences of the possible resettlement of the Muslim population and the probability that they could demand the right to vote in the region. These, according to Marwan, could lead to an imbalance of the already fragile balance between Muslims and Christians. The National Bloc lost two-thirds of their vote over the last elections in the northern region near the city of Byblos. General Michel Aoun won 70% of the suffrage among the Christian community. Back from 15 years of exile after the departure of Syrian troops in 2005, Aoun made an electoral deal with Hezbollah and counts them among his supporters. This might be one of the reasons that explains why the population expressed more solidarity than hostility towards the refugees, since hostilities broke out nearly 4 weeks ago. Omaya Khalife's 48 librarian who voted for Michel Aoun. She describes the solidarity expressed by her community towards the refugees.
Ils sont en train d'aider les gens de l'argent. Des habits, le manger.
They are helping people with money, food, and clothes, with everything. For example, in my village, Béjé, every Sunday during the Mass, there are two or three men who collect money for the refugees settled in the region, and there are two other men who collect clothes. It is not like the civil war we had before.
Fadi Abiaqel lives in the same village. He is 42 years old, and he runs his own company settled in Libya. Like the majority of the population living near Byblos, he is a supporter of General Michel Aoun. He spoke to FSRN on Sunday after hearing a report about 12 Israeli soldiers killed in a Hezbollah rocket attack.
I am a Christian person. Mainly I'm Maronite. I have never been participating during the whole civil war to any militia. But now I'm with the Hezbollah and I really bend in front of them, in front of their leader, Mr. Hassan Nasrallah, the way he is defending our country.
In targeting specifically the southern Shia region, many analysts in Lebanon think that the goal of the Israeli army was to raise anger among the Christian community, splitting the public opinion and sparking communal tensions. But the violence of the strikes throughout Lebanon, with overwhelming numbers of civilian dead, and the alliance between the leader of Hezbollah and the Christian party of General Aoun, is showing support of the resistance from at least one significant segment of Christians in Lebanon. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Khalid Sid Mohan in Beirut.
At least 1,000 Lebanese people, more than 800 of them civilians, and 97 Israelis, 33 of them civilians, have been killed in the three-week-long war. But while Israeli officials present a united front to the world media, the reality on the ground is a far more fractured populace, Jenka Soderberg reports.
Brothers Rabia and Mahmoud Abu Talouzi were among the first Israeli victims of the war with Lebanon. They were Israeli Arabs from the city of Nazareth. The most recent civilian deaths from Hezbollah rocket fire were also Arabs, a Bedouin mother and her two daughters killed in the Western Galilee over the weekend. But residents of the Arab towns and villages in northern Israel do not blame Hezbollah for firing the rocket so much as they blame the Israeli government. Reem Natur, a resident of Nazareth.
If you talk about probability, Arabs are about 40% of the population in northern Israel and the Galilee. We know that Arab cities and villages are not targeted, but unfortunately it happens. The majority of Arabs here believe that Israel is responsible about this war. And with all the pain and maybe anger, but we can still see, politically speaking, who is the responsible.
The mayor of Nazareth, Ramez Jaraisi, says he has been asking the Israeli government for funds to build public shelters in the city for some time, but that the Israeli government has not provided for its Israeli Arab citizens. Dr. Basil Gattas is the head of the Galilee Society in Nazareth.
And we don't have any public shelters in the Arab towns and villages. In cities like Nazareth and Shefa Amer, also in the Arab neighborhoods in Haifa and Acre, there are no shelters. Actually, we are exposed to direct threat by these rockets. Even in the beginning of the war, most of the Arab villages and towns were outside the siren range. So we didn't hear that there are sirens in the nearby Jewish villages and cities. Only after many rockets directly hit some Arab localities that the government ought to install such sirens inside the Arab towns and villages.
For the Jewish citizens of Upper Nazareth, the neighboring Jewish city, there are a number of shelters, leading to the claims of discrimination by many in the Israeli Arab town. Leaders within the Israeli left, while having organized protests in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, have been disappointed in the way many in the country have lined up behind the war and have criticized the former Peace Bloc member, who is now Israeli Defense Minister, Amir Peretz. Former Israeli parliamentarian Uri Avneri.
There's been an overwhelming national consensus in favor of the war at the beginning, but now you hear a lot of criticism, not so much against the war as such, but against the lack of planning, which allowed for a situation where hundreds of thousands of Israelis are now living in shelters for weeks. It's President Bush who decides what the Israeli government will accept with this war. He started this war. He sustained us throughout the war. He's sending us bombs so we can continue the bombardment of Lebanon. I wonder exactly what he is thinking, if you can call it thinking. It is very difficult to divine what he really has in mind.
On the Israeli far right, the war has also been criticized, seen as part of Prime Minister Ehud Olmert's convergence plan for settlers living in the Palestinian West Bank. When the Israeli military's chief rabbi, Sergeant Yehuda Greenfeld, was killed by a Katyusha rocket from Hezbollah on Sunday, his sister, Shosha Greenfeld, called on soldiers to refuse orders for a war which she said was part of an Israeli government plan to remove Israeli settlers from their homes. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Jenka Soderberg reporting from the Galilee.
As Israel continues its invasion of Lebanon, the United States military is stepping up its attack on the movement of Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr in Iraq. Like Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Sadr movement has millions of members, opposes the Israeli and U.S. Army, and provides social services for the poor. Aaron Glantz and Salam Talib report.
It would be hard to find a stronger opponent of Israel's invasion of Lebanon than Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Here is part of his most recent sermon, delivered Friday in the holy city of Kufa.
What the Zionist enemy is doing in Lebanon is historical hatred. They hate everybody. They don't discriminate their attacks between a kid and an old man, between a civil service office and a military installation. They don't discriminate between resistance fighters and civilians. They don't believe in anything but violence and terrorism. They are the main terrorists in the world and the enemy of every Muslim in the world.
While Sadr delivered his sermon, tens of thousands of his followers rallied in Baghdad. They brandished photos of the head of Hezbollah, Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah, and burned the American flag. Despite its size, the demonstration did not go off without a hitch, however. Abbas al-Rubai is the cleric's public relations chief in Najaf.
There were demonstrators coming to Baghdad from the south of Iraq. When they arrived in Mahmoudiya, there were some cars of the American military. We don't know if they planned for it or were accidentally there, but when they saw the demonstrators' cars, they shot at them. The demonstrators were detained by the Americans, who said they had weapons, but they didn't. And we have 7 to 10 people killed and many injured.
After the demonstration, the U.S. military continued its attacks on the Sadr movement. On Sunday, American troops laid siege to Sadr City in East Baghdad, killing about 10 people and injuring dozens more. During the one-hour gun battle, Al Jazeera reports, the U.S. military also bombed the area's main gas station and demolished many houses. The U.S. military maintains the attacks are part of a crackdown on Shiite death squads, but Sadr movement spokesman Abbas al-Rubai has another explanation.
We suspect a relationship between the demonstration and the attacks, especially since the Americans are very big supporters of the Israeli attack in Lebanon. So they are attacking anybody who is opposing their position in Lebanon, especially those in Iraq. In addition, the relationship between the Sadr movement and the U.S. has never been settled. It's always been tense for the last 3 years. It's an uncooperative relationship. There is now a ceasefire, but there is no agreement on the point of views.
The American attack was immediately condemned by Iraq's Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, but it's found support among other parts of Iraq's political spectrum. Like other prominent Sunni politicians, Adnan Dulaimi had until recently had kind words for the armed resistance. But now, he says, he fears Shiite militias more than the U.S. military.
That's a really sad situation, but it's a reality. The Iraqis don't get upset when the Americans detain somebody because they know that he is in safe hands and they will never be tortured or drilled in the head or be found killed and thrown in the river somewhere. Or they will find him in the sewer or just find the body in the morgue. And when the family goes to the morgue, they try to kill the family. It's so sad what's happened, that a people feel safer with the occupation more than with the forces from their own country. It's a strange position and it's painful.
Some observers say the U.S. government is repeating mistakes it made in earlier wars. Winslow Wheeler spent 30 years as a national security staffer on Capitol Hill and now works for the nonprofit Center for Defense Information.
We tend to do this in our occupations. We did it in Beirut, Lebanon in 1982, where we actually were welcomed with opened arms. We took sides in the incipient civil war in Beirut, and the side that we didn't side with started as the side that blew up the Marines barrack in 1983. We did the same thing in Somalia. We were welcomed with opened arms. We began to take sides in the political disputes between the various warlords there and got ourselves in the middle of the sectarian fight.
Wheeler says that by attacking the Sadr movement, the U.S. military is inserting itself in the middle of Iraq's civil war with possibly catastrophic results. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz with Salam Talib.
The first trees were chopped down in a pristine roadless area yesterday since the Bush administration repealed a 2001 rule last year, which protected 58 million acres of unspoiled forest land. About 100 demonstrators from Oregon rallied in front of the Forest Service office in Medford, Oregon, protesting the tree's destruction. As FSRN's Jacob Fenston reports, 12 protesters were arrested when they occupied the crosswalk in front of the agency's office.
Roadless is priceless. Roadless is priceless. Roadless is priceless.
That's protester Nicholas Coletto, a 17-year-old Portlander being arrested by Medford police. 10 other protesters were detained along with a legal observer, who approached the police van with a digital camera as people were being booked. Protesters flowed into Southern Oregon from all parts of the state and belong to all age groups.
I want to come out to save the trees.
Why do you want to save the trees?
So people can still breathe?
That's Paiute of Silver Creek Road. Protesters say the majority of the American public is on their side and wants unspoiled roadless areas protected. When the 2001 Roadless Area Protection Rule passed, the Forest Service received more comments from the public than any federal agency ever had on any rule. 95% of those comments were in favor. Tim Rehm is one of the organizers of the protest. He says the Bush administration is going ahead with these two roadless sales in Oregon for purely political reasons.
They are trying to crack open this rule because this is the first domino in a game that for them means 58.5 million acres of forest that's otherwise protected.
The Forest Service acknowledges the purpose of the sales is not ecological. Patty Burrell, Forest Service spokeswoman.
The primary purpose of these timber sales was to provide for the local economy.
But according to activists, the Forest Service is actually losing money on the sales. Josh Laughlin, executive director of Cascadia Wildlands Project, says the timber is being sold for about $200 per logging truck load.
That's cheaper than firewood, and this is our heritage forest being squandered away.
Laughlin's group has been fighting to prevent logging in several court cases. 4 suits are still pending that could put an end to the logging, but it's unlikely they'll be ruled on in time to do so. Last week, a U.S. district judge in California failed to rule on a request for a temporary injunction that would have halted the timber sales. The injunction was requested by Governor Ted Kulongoski as part of a larger lawsuit challenging the repeal of the Roadless Area Protection Rule. In the case, 4 Western states argue the Bush administration failed to provide adequate public input on the 2005 rule change. Activists say they'll keep fighting until they get the roadless rule back. Direct action is planned throughout the week in the South Kalmiopsis area. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jacob Fenston in Medford, Oregon.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in LA, I'm Ara Bogado.